Hi, Greg Perry, the Historic Preservationist. Welcome to Season 3, Episode 21. Putting our horological, our antiquarian horological caps on today, let's talk about early time and telling of time in the colonial, what will become America, in the colonies. So early time and telling of time in the early colonies. So in 1686, self-styled student of mathematics and astrologer Samuel Atkins authored a 39-page almanac called Calendarium. In it, he recorded that the people he encountered while traveling through Pennsylvania, Maryland, and adjacent areas generally complained that they scarcely knew how the time had passed, nor that they hardly knew the day of the rest or the Lord's Day when it was called then. Although Atkins framed his comment to include the entire Delaware Valley, nowhere in this area of travel would it have been truer than at the confluence of the Delaware and Schuylkill Rivers, where one of the colonial America's great cities, first cities, Philadelphia, is situated. Atkins' purpose in publishing his book was not simply to note of those he encountered that they had difficulty knowing the hour of the day or the day of the week, but to offer a remedy for that such dilemma. So on the title page, he stated that he had detailed the motions of the planets through the signs of the zodiac, with the luminaries, conjunctions, aspect, eclipses, the rising, southing, and setting of the moon, with the time when she passeth, sun rising and setting, and the time of high water at the city of Philadelphia. I had thoughts to have inserted a figure of the moon eclipse, and a table to find the hour of the day by the shadow of a staff. He was unable to include those elements prior to publication, but promised to do so in a second edition. That Atkins devoted the bulk of his almanac to celestial and naturally reoccurring phenomena, while post-positioning a table to tell the hour, strongly suggests that many of his readers looked to their environment rather than mathematical or mechanical aids for clues in telling of time. This is perhaps to be expected in a settlement founded a mere 4 years prior and still being wrestled with from its primitive state of being. Nature continued to be a dominant and controlling force in the lives of those living in William Penn's green country town and its surrounding area, but that was soon to change. Early residents of Pennsylvania had many reasons for wanting to keep track of time. In some instances, their needs were hourly, as with the preparation of meals. Others were daily, such as caring for livestock, or seasonal, or as with the planting and harvesting of crops. There was no need for a high degree of precision in identifying these respective timetables. However, all were familiar to be Europeans who had accepted Penn's invitation to emigrate to America and could be accommodated for the most part by referencing the movement of the sun, the moon, and other natural phenomena. Dividing the day into meaningful units using the sun as a point of reference is known as solar time. It is practiced by observing the movement of the shadow cast by a genome across the graduated scale of a sundial. Like the sundial recorded in the common room of Philadelphia merchant George Hutchinson in 1698, the year of his death, Hutchinson would have kept his sundial with the point of the genome pointed to true north on a windowsill or post outside a window of his house for easy viewing. Noting its shadow, he could plan his day and assign specific activities to any given time. His dial was surely one of many numerous in use throughout Philadelphia, but from shortly thereafter, if not at the time of the city's founding. The city's first historian, antiquarian John Fanning Watson, devoted considerable comment to sundials on his Annals of Philadelphia and Pennsylvania in the Olden Time, which was first published in 1830. He observed that none of the dials Watson cited are known to have survived. However, one made in Philadelphia during the early 1700s defines the character of those used in that time. It bears inscriptions referencing two individuals, the maker, Philip Roman Fecht, engraved at the perimeter, and the owner, Henry Warrington, 1726. Noted within a circle at the point of the genome, the triangular genome and circular plate of the sundial were thickly cast in brass, and the latter was competently but coarsely engraved with Roman numerals, from 5 a.m. to 7 p.m, on a circumvented scale, measuring 15-minute intervals. Philip Roman identified himself as a practitioner of physic, or as sure we know as a physics, in his will, dated November 6, 1730, in Philadelphia. Warrington called himself a yeoman in his will, written August 6, 1765, in Chester Township, Burlington County, New Jersey. As Watson recorded, sundials were useful to Philadelphians in the execution of their commerce and furtherance of their politics and the practice of all their religions, all weighty matters in the minds of those involved. Dials also served to mark specific times for more mundane matters, which might include the gathering at taverns, such as, you know, the Indian King Tavern on Market Street, the City Tavern or the Shivers Tavern, or even in the coffee houses like Widow Roberts, situated on Front Street. In addition to dials mounted vertically to the walls of buildings and horizontally on posts, handheld pocket sundials designed specifically for portability were also used by Philadelphians. These were small and were always accompanied by a compass to orientate the hinged genome toward magnetic north. William Penn is reputed to have given a pocket sundial to Pennsylvania's Lieutenant Governor Thomas Lloyd about 1690. Such dials were particularly useful for keeping track of time when traveling away from home. In addition to identifying a point in time, dials could also indicate elapsed time, although sand glasses were a more precise alternative, also known as hourglasses, or even some call them time glasses. Sand glasses consist of two glass bulbs connected by a very narrow neck, held within a wood or ivory or even a metal frame. They're designed to measure a specified length of time as gravity feeds the sand from the upper to the lower bulb chamber. Their small size, modest value, and everyday purpose relegate them to infrequent mention in historical records. While they are known to have been in use actively in Philadelphia through the late 17th and early 19th century. City merchant Jonathan Dickinson had a 1/2 hourglass and 2-minute hourglasses in his store at the time of his death in 1722 in his inventory. See, these inventories are very, very valuable to us today. Merchant John Rennell recorded that he received via his ship, the John Gallery, from London on July 11th, 1746, 2 1/4-minute glasses, 4 1/2-minute glasses, 4 1/2-hour glasses, and 1 2-hour glass, all for timekeeping on his new vessel, the Tetsworth, being built at the Philadelphia dockyard. Their competitor, merchant Joseph Redman, listed 1/2 hourglass and 1/2 minute glass in his inventory of his brigantine, Joseph and John, at the time of his death in 1722. The appraiser of estate also identified a 23-ounce and a 6-time glasses at 6 dozen in his store for sale to householders, mariners, teachers, and or ministers. A diminutive sand glass in an ivory frame, measuring 2 minutes and 10 seconds, was owned by Philadelphia-born Quaker minister and schoolmistress Rebecca Jones. It is likely one of several, each recording a different length of time, she used to keep track of time while teaching. Those sand glasses were equally important for her ministering. Like many of her professions, Jones also fired with religious zeal that motivated her to expound at length on the Word of God. Sand glasses served as a helpful time constraint for her and limitations on preaching, lest the listeners lose the necessary attentiveness and proper devotional attitude that was required of them. Holding the attention of listening by judicious control of speaking time was one matter, but determining a meeting time and having all concerned assemble in a timely manner was quite another matter. Gatherings for individuals, for whatever purpose, called for a universal system of marking time that everyone could accept and access readily and easily. So hence, we jump into the town clock. A sense of time, coupled with the willingness to regulate one's activities in accordance with the passing, proved to be increasingly important to those in European cities by the onset of the Renaissance. But not coincidentally, that was the period when mechanical clockworks and bells to strike the hours made their first appearance. Such devices were pioneered by the Catholic Church to help regulate the daily routine of monastic life, but they were soon adapted for secular use also. And they became known as tower clocks, town clocks, or town bells. They were seen by some as having been invented to allow the citizens of honorable cities to live orderly lives and to call sleepers and idlers to virtuous works. The speed and enthusiasm with which they were adopted by cities throughout Europe prompted one observer to state that in 1410, that in cities and towns, people ruled themselves by the clock, appending lives previously lived in accordance with nature's daily cycle. The relationship between striking clockworks and organized urban life had become deeply entrenched in European thinking by the time Penn laid out his plan for the Philadelphia streets. Consequently, a town bell was among the first civil constructs undertaken, as evidenced on a map in Philadelphia dated 1698. English made, the bell stood in a small building at the intersection of High, which is now Market Street, and Second Streets. The city's geographic, political, social, and legal nerve center of the day. It was hand-operated, probably by one or more individuals, under the auspices of the Common Council, a committee of men responsible for the care and functioning of the city. By referring to a sundial, weather permitting, or perhaps a mechanical timepiece, the bell ringer struck daylight hours for the community. This simple, yet effective, town clock served as a means by which the hours for work and meals to laborers are fixed and known. Among the more important commercial activities the bell governed was the weekly market that took place on Wednesdays and Saturdays. Regulations adopted in 1693 stipulated that it began to be opened at ye ringing of the bell. From the first day of ye second month of April to ye first day of the first day of September between the hours of 6 and 7, and from the first day of September to the first day of April, from the hours of 8 to 9. This may be the earliest instance of a two-tiered seasonal timing schedule in American colonial history that heralded the concept of daylight savings time. The town bell was essential to citizens and visitors alike. As referenced in the minutes of the Common Council in September 29th of 1705, it is ordered that the beadle and the constables of the city give notice to the firemen of the same to appear on Monday morning at the hours of 8, to be informed of their privileges. In the absence of the town bell, lawgivers and freemen alike risked missed meetings not by knowing when the hour of 8 occurred. The bell synchronized the disparate activities of all individuals and groups within hearing so that life in Philadelphia could proceed in an orderly manner. Philadelphia's town bell served effectively during daylight hours, but many citizens also wanted to know what time it was after the sun set. An alternative system for counting the hours at night, therefore, had to be devised. Following a European precedent, the city fathers put such a system into effect on July 1, 1700. It is recorded in the minutes of the Common Council that a watchman be appointed, authorized, and even empowered, to go round ye town with a small bell in ye nighttime to give notice of ye time of night. The night sky was the watchman's signpost for announcing the hours. As the moon and stars made their trek across the heavens, they conveyed a sense of every time bit as tangible as the sun for the informed observer. The American Almanac, first published by Daniel Leeds in Philadelphia in 1687, and continued well after his death by his son Titian, served as a handbook for watchmen and others who were interested in reading the night sky. Among its standard annual offerings were the luminations, the planets' motions and mutual aspects, and seven stars southing, rising, and even setting. Philadelphia was growing quite rapidly. The observations of its early residents address this transformation, as with commentary offered by local Swedish pastors Andreas Rudman and Andreas Sandell. Rudman wrote in 1700 that if anyone were to see Philadelphia, he would be astonished beyond measure that it was founded less than only 20 years ago. All the houses were built of brick, and 300 or 400 of them, in fact, and in every house a shop, so that whatever one wants at any time, he can have. For money, he can create his own money. If a young merchant with a good understanding of business were to come here, he could grow unbelievably rich in a very short time. Sandell wrote 2 years later, "Philadelphia is a very pretty town, not more than 20 years old or so, as I just said, but having, nevertheless, even 500 brick homes now, and many distinguished people. The governor and his court, the mayor, the magistrates, officers, secretaries, lawyers, etc. And many merchants go splendidly dressed down the street." In response to Philadelphia's growth and attendant wealth, it became necessary to adjust and expand the night watch. At their meeting on December 1st, 1704, the Common Council ordered that the inhabitants of this city be divided into 10 precincts, and each constable being in number to have an equal number of assigned to serve upon them the watch, and that 9 persons beside the constable attend the watch throughout each night. The members of this volunteer group converted to a paid force in 1751. They were charged with patrolling the streets in their respective precincts, to keep watch and ward, and from the 10th day of the month, called March, to the 10th day of September of every year, from the hours of 10 in the evening until the next morning light. And from the 10th day of September to the 10th day of the month called March in every year, from 9 in the evening until 6 in the morning. Again, daylight savings time. Concurrent with the institution of the night watch, the Common Council began to petition the governor for a courthouse, Philadelphia's first, as a place for their frequent meetings and their other political needs. A three-story building was thus erected at the center of High Street, just west of its intersection with 2nd Street, shortly before 1710. It was then determined that the street-level hand-rung town bell was insufficient for the needs of the city, so it was moved to a cupola atop the roof and fitted with a mechanical clockwork for the first time. Pictorial and manuscript evidence indicate that the mechanism lacked a clock dial and provided an oral indication of the hours only, and was the case with many of its European antecedents also. This town clock immediately became an essential part of everyday life in Philadelphia, providing guidance and direction for a multitude of activities. Amply noted in the written record, on October 25, 1714, the Common Council ordered the mayor, recorder, aldermen, and its members to wait upon the governor on Wednesday next at ye hour of 12 in the afternoon. On April 30th of 1724, the American Weekly Mercury gave notice that a newly arrived troupe of rope dancers would perform at the New Booth on Society Hill, to begin exactly at 7 o'clock in the evening. The same newspaper announced that on April 22, 1735, the worldly goods of the recently deceased William Bunting would be offered at an auction between the hours of 10 and 12 in the forenoon. A further instance is cited on September 19, 1728, in the issue of the Boston Newsletter, wherein appears a small account concerning the market house beyond the courthouse at Philadelphia and how the markets are managed. Our market days are Wednesday and Saturday. No hucksters buy more than shall be judged necessary, at least to their family or on market day to market day, before our town clock strikes 10. So no hucksters in the market before the clock strikes 10. Then at liberty, they can buy as much as they please after the hour of 10 strikes. So this town clock served the public's timekeeping needs through the 1740s, when it and the building into which it was located were no longer deemed adequate for a city that had grown to at least 1,500 houses and 13,000 people. Indeed, construction of a larger courthouse, the State House, now known as Independence Hall, had begun in 1732 on Chestnut Street between 5th and 6th, and continued until completion in 1753. A new and improved town clock was then installed, with a large clock to strike on the bell, and a suitable dial plate to show the hours and even the minutes. The locally made clockworks and bell imported from England, not the Liberty Bell here, so let's don't get confused, were located in the attic, and two large clock dials with hands were installed at the east and west ends of the building. The new clock began providing the standard of time reference for city residents, and the old one, though, was retired. Among those acknowledged and recorded its place in their lives was the Friendly Association for Reigning and Preserving Peace with the Indians by Pacific Measures, organized in Philadelphia in 1756. One of the rules of that organization stated that any member would first be fined for not attending punctually at the time appointed the meeting, which is to be determined by the State House clock. That clock, under the auspices of the Pennsylvania Assembly, continued to serve the community until 1777, just before the city was occupied by the British during the Revolution. So that's going to be the first episode or first part one of our episode of the beginning of timekeeping in the colonies, and I hope everyone enjoyed it. And don't forget, if you want to hear more about the historic preservationist, all lowercase, find us on Instagram. We have hundreds and hundreds of videos and talking about horological aspects, antiquarian horological aspects, videos in my conservation studio, on site, and museums. Also, videos about restoring and conserving decorative arts, primarily wooden furniture. Wood's my passion. And architectural preservation. And also go to our YouTube channel. You know, we have probably around 100 videos on there, and some of them anywhere from, you know, first glass making in America to some opinions. And we want everyone to stay tuned, because we are going to be putting on a weekly show from the conservation studio. It's going to run about a half hour to 40 minutes. And it's going to be very structured. It's going to, you know, we'll deal with the object of the week. We'll do some explanation of that. We'll field some of the questions written in by a lot of my followers, maybe look at a tool or something like that. So we're putting this together now. I think it'd be great interest to everyone. And you'll find this on YouTube at the Historic Preservationist. So Greg Perry signing out. Thanks, everyone, for listening.